Your opponent is going to argue by a speakerphone today, Mr. McGowan. All right, the first case is 07-1237, United States versus Terrell Thomas. Mr. McGowan, always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you, Your Honor. The pleasure is mutual. Good morning, Your Honors. Andrew McGowan on behalf of the Federal Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. On behalf of Terrell Thomas, in this case, Mr. Thomas appeals the district court's denial of his motion to suppress. There are three parts to this brief. The third part has to do with statements that were made after the searches. Unless there are any questions about the statements, I intend to address the searches. Mr. Thomas was a passenger in a van driven by his wife, was stopped because a light behind the license, the back, was off. The officer who ordered the stop believed that he had reasonable suspicion to frisk Mr. Thomas based on information from a confidential informant. However, based on the nature of the confidential informant's information, its age, which was approximately a month and a half old, I don't believe this even amounts to knowledge of his criminal history, which this court has found does not establish reasonable suspicion in and of itself. The other factors that went into this traffic stop, I don't believe in total, also establish reasonable suspicion. And I understand that reasonable suspicion is a very low standard. But at the same time, not much happened.
He justified the search simply on the basis of his not getting out of the automobile when he was asked to do so.
And there were a couple aspects to that too. He asked questions when the officer ordered him out. But that exchange lasted very briefly, and it wasn't that he was resisting getting out of the car. He was just asking the officer why. The officer didn't tell him why, and he finally got out. And it was a very brief exchange, and I don't believe that was kind of innocent, actually. The struggle is a little different matter, and I believe that depends on whether the officers had reasonable suspicion at that time to seize him at all. As this court knows, at a traffic stop, passengers can be ordered out of the car. The Supreme Court's said that's fine. But I don't believe that there's authority from any court that really establishes that officers can do something to that passenger after the passenger's ordered out of the car. For instance, in this case, Mr. Thomas was close to his home. I believe he could have walked home without the officer being able to grab him. And as I pointed out in my brief,
did he say that he saw a hand movement?
He did.
And doesn't that kind of play into things here?
Again, that's a very brief moment. In fact, it was evidently so quick that the officer didn't even have time to react. It was before the officer even recognized that it was Mr. Thomas who was doing it. He was coming up from the side and saw the hand movement and came out. Now, of course, the gun wasn't even found there. There's no explanation in the record for the hand movement. But at that point, the officer was talking to the wife on the driver's side. And he could have been asking for identification. In fact, I believe there was some testimony he was. I'm forgetting whether that was ruled on or not. But the fact that somebody puts their hand in their pocket, in a jacket pocket like this, I think that's an innocent fact at this point because it was so quick. It wasn't as if, of course, the officer was concerned, but that doesn't necessarily establish reasonable suspicion. And, of course, even if this court finds that there was reasonable suspicion for that initial search, what I'm calling the second search, which is actually just a continuation of this, I believe was unreasonably done. And I say that for a couple of reasons. And I understand the district court didn't rule on it, and I was surprised the district court didn't rule on it. It was litigated. But the way the search was conducted, it was in front of a school. It was early in the evening, about 8:30. It was a well-lit residential street. And the officer, during his pat-down search, found evidence that there was something in my client's anus. And he searched him by having him stand outside the van, a fact that the district court didn't rule on, but the evidence is clear, and the officer admitted that. And he The officer didn't remember if he unbuckled his pants or not. The officer didn't remember if the pants went down below or not. But these are all considerations for the court. And because the district court didn't rule on this, I believe that this is one of those kind of cases that this court would typically send back for further findings.
If he had not been searched, that more thorough search, and been taken into custody for resisting or something, would the drugs, golf ball size, shape, have been inevitably discovered?
Perhaps. In fact, I think you're probably right. It would have been discovered. And my point in this argument, and the law on this fact, is not that the officers can't search. It's the manner in which they search. And I'm not saying that they couldn't have taken to the police office. If they had taken the police station and it came out somehow that way, I probably wouldn't be here arguing this today. If they had taken him behind a bush, if they had shown one iota of interest in protecting him from public view, I would not be standing here arguing this today.
Is there any evidence about like a crowd gathering or anything like that?
There was no evidence of a crowd gathering.
Anybody seeing it?
Nobody asked. His wife did. Well, his wife saw him. I would ask this court to consider if the roles were reversed, if the husband were watching the wife being searched in this manner. It's beyond the pale.
That happened in Crash, and that won the Academy Award, in the movie.
Well, I can't really say anything about Hollywood. But the other thing I'd like this court to consider is, to the extent that there's the exclusionary rule has to do with police officers intentionally violating the Constitution, I don't know that the officer intentionally violated, but he was not paying enough attention to this one particular aspect of the search. He located evidence to establish that there was evidence to search further, but he didn't even care enough to remember whether he loosened the belt, which is probably very likely that he did, or that the pants fell down around his knees. I think that's an indication that this officer does the search very frequently. He doesn't care where it is. It's in front of a school, broad daylight. I can't say that for sure, but it just seems that that's an indication. And as I say, to the extent the exclusionary rule covers these sorts of things, because of police misconduct, I'd like the court to take that into account. Unless there are any questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Mullen?
Yes, Linda Mullen on behalf of the United States. May it please the court. I would first like to express my appreciation for the panel's willingness to allow me to argue by speakerphone today, and I trust that you will jump in and let me know if I need to adjust my volume or if I'm not hearing a question that you're trying to ask.
We'll do that. We'll also tell you when your light is on.
Thank you. I hope I don't talk so long that I need to be interrupted for that. I really only have a few comments to make today, and what we'd like to emphasize is that the defendant's argument really ignores critical facts as found by the district court, and because he ignores them, he really provides this court no reason to deem them clearly erroneous. Accepting the facts as found by the district court, it's clear that the officer's actions here were reasonable throughout the traffic stop. I'd actually like to start where Mr. McGowan left off, and that is with what he is calling a strip or body cavity search, and he represents in his brief and also to the court this morning that the district court simply didn't make findings on this issue. And if you read the district court's order, it's clear that the court did make findings on this issue. The officers testified, the defendant testified. Their versions of what happened dramatically differed from one another. The officer who actually conducted the search testified that after finding the loaded gun in the defendant's waistband and the drugs in the gun, or the drugs and the money in his pocket, before transporting the defendant to the police station, he conducted a more thorough search. The court found that the defendant's shoes and socks were searched, that the officer patted down the outer clothing of the defendant, and when he reached the defendant's butt buttocks area outside of his jeans, he felt a bulge. He asked the defendant if there was something there. The defendant responded to the officer, yes, there is something there. The officer put on a rubber glove, reached into his underwear, and pulled the golf ball-sized ball of crack from between his buttocks. Now, the district court didn't specifically say, I reject the defendant's testimony that this was a body cavity or strip search. But the district court's findings really leave no doubt that the district court credited the officer's testimony that the defendant's pants were not pulled down. His private parts were not exposed to the public. He was not body cavity or strip searched at any time. Mr. McGowan also says that the defendant's wife witnessed it. She testified that the only thing she saw was that the defendant's pants were pulled down. Again, that's contrary to the police officer's testimony and the implicit findings of the district court. She did not testify that she witnessed any sort of strip search or body cavity search of the defendant. So again, it's important, I think, in assessing the reasonableness of the officer's actions to look at the facts as found by the district court here. The district court had the opportunity to hear these witnesses and assess their credibility, and those were the facts that were found. Yes, it was in front of a public high school, but it was December 28th, so I think it's a reasonable inference from the record that this was not a school night. There's certainly nothing in the record to suggest that there were any passersby or onlookers or any activities at the high school that evening or that anyone saw this. And, of course, either side could have asked those questions and didn't, so the record is silent in terms of any sort of foot traffic or other witnesses that might have been present. With respect to the initial stop, of course, the defendant concedes that the traffic stop was proper and that the officer could properly order him out of the car under Maryland v. Wilson. I think that the more recent Supreme Court case of Brenlin suggests that the officers certainly could have kept the defendant there, that there's language in that case saying that passengers have to realize that an officer is going to want to maintain control of everyone on the scene of a traffic stop for his own safety. It isn't clear that this defendant succumbed to the police officer's authority even after exiting the van. He didn't do that until the officer ordered him out of the van three different times. And then, according to the officer, the defendant attempted to flee, tried to maneuver his body between the officer and the door. And that was another factual finding that the district court made, that the defendant did, in fact, attempt to walk between the officer and the van door instead of remaining at the side of the van, and that the officer believed he was attempting to flee, grabbed his wrist, and at that point the defendant struggled for an additional 45 seconds until two officers subdued him, and that was only after they threatened to use a taser on him. So really the officers could consider everything up until that point in terms of whether or not they had reasonable suspicion that criminal activity was afoot, whether they had reason to fear for their safety, and certainly whether the defendant had obstructed or impeded an officer's official act. The district court found, of course, the two alternative bases, both that they had reasonable suspicion and that the defendant had committed a violation of Illinois law such that the officers could arrest and search him at that point. So, again, if we look at the facts as found by the district court, facts that the defendant does not give this court any reason to deem clearly erroneous, it's clear that the officers behaved reasonably throughout the traffic stop. And for that reason, we would ask that this court affirm the district court's denial of the defendant's motion to suppress.
Okay. Mr. McGowan, anything further? Okay, thank you to both sides. Mr. McGowan, your usual fine job representing your client. We thank you and your office for taking the appointment. Okay.